Welcome to Cattle HQ, a podcast from industry experts and progressive producers discussing cutting-edge info about the cow-calf sector to keep cattlemen and women in the know and positively affect their bottom line.
Welcome to the Cattle HQ podcast, brought to you by South Dakota State University Extension. I am Taylor Grusing, cow-calf field specialist based out of Mitchell, along with co-host Addie Stamps, SDSU Extension Livestock Production and Stewardship field specialist. Joining us today, we have two special guests, Dr. Warren Ruschi and Dr. Zach Smith, both based out of Brookings, South Dakota. Dr. Ruschi is our assistant professor and feedlot specialist with SDSU Extension on campus, who provides nutrition expertise to South Dakotans and neighboring states through various programs, including the recent 2025 Siouxland Feedlot Forum. And then we also have Dr. Smith, who is an assistant professor at South Dakota State University, working with Dr. Ruschi to lead several of their research projects in the region. So welcome to the podcast, guys.
Hey, Taylor. Thanks for having us.
Good afternoon.
So to kick things off, I guess I gave you guys a brief, very brief introduction, but let's let both of you take time to introduce yourself, your background, highlight any of the research you're currently focusing on or what you've been doing kind of in your tenure at SDSU.
We'll let Warren go first and I'll fill in the holes.
All right. So, I guess spent nearly all my career working in one way, shape, or form in the South Dakota beef industry, whether that was starting out in county extension in the 90s, then transitioned over to working on our family's operation where we ran a custom backgrounding yard and then also had a cow-calf herd. About 10, 11 years ago, I came back to South Dakota State, first as a cow-calf field specialist and then transitioned to the feedlot role here in the last few years. So my interests are really revolves around what makes the South Dakota beef industry money, specifically in this case of how do we use the feeds that we grow here with the cattle that are born here in order to generate more income for the people that live and make South Dakota their home. So some of the research areas we've worked on, we've done some work on different strategies with silage. Worked with feeding hybrid rye. That was part of my PhD work. And then we've followed up with some other studies. More recently, Dr. Smith and I have been working on looking at things like different protein supplement strategies, specifically involving either soybean meal or heat-treated soybeans. Those have been, so really I've focused mostly on, the things that we grow and then how do we turn those into dollars through cattle. Let Zach talk about some of his areas that kind of align with that overall theme.
Yep. Zach Smith, originally born in Little Rock, Arkansas, Maumelle to be exact, Addie, and then moved to Central Florida when I was six. And we spent about 9 years in Central Florida. And after our time in Florida, we moved to West Texas, back to where my mom grew up. Finished high school in West Texas, went to Texas Tech, and actually came up to SDSU many times during my college career as I was on competitive judging teams, did wool meets and livestock. In fact, that's where Taylor and I first met, was our wool judging days. We'd make trips up here for the international, come stop by when we were on the Royal Road trip, and come to campus at SDSU. Campus here for my second tenure. We moved here in July of 2018. Got started and then been here ever since. My wife actually works on campus. Our boys are being raised Jackrabbit fans. I ask them what other teams they like. They're straight Jackrabbits. From academic interest, really, I would say so. Warren was pretty, he was specific on what we're working on. I would say the feedlot research group, which it's twofold. It's Zach Warren and other collaborators, but Dr. Ruschi handles a lot of our outreach. He's very involved with designing studies and coming up with new ideas. I'm kind of the one that handles the numbers side of our business, not the economic numbers, but the research data. And I would really say, if I had to say a 30,000 foot view of what we do, is really management and nutrition interventions or strategies from the time a calf is weaned until all the way till we get to the end product that a consumer would purchase and buy. So it's a pretty broad facet of beef production in South Dakota. That looks like a different than what it does in other parts of the U.S. It's all confinement-based cattle production, so cattle being fed harvested forages in confinement from about 500 pounds till we ship them somewhere between 1,500 and 1,800 pounds. So a pretty broad space. Personally, I've always been interested in growth-enhancing technologies, whether that be steroidal implants or beta-adrenergic agonist. But I've had to learn a lot about farming and farmer feeder business from Dr. Rushi. So we have, I guess I'd say, complementary skill sets in the way we try to attack and solve problems, which are ultimately the goal is to benefit those that live in rural areas of America that choose to in this part of the world, at least integrate cropping systems into livestock production systems. And that's kind of the, I guess, the, how do I say this? A set of binoculars we use to identify, find problems, and create new research questions that really, a lot of times they're just from what we hear in and outside from people, our stakeholders in the state. They're really the ones that motivate us and tell us what we ought to be working on next. And then it's just up to us to put the boots and the personnel to the ground to solve those problems.
So today's theme we wanted to kind of kick off today was receiving new calves into the feed yard. I don't think we kind of mentioned that previously. So Addie, I'll kind of take it away with some of the first questions.
Yes, and we're going to keep you talking, Dr. Smith. And tell us what are some key things that you look for when you're sourcing calves for research that may also translate to feed yards as they're purchasing.
Yeah, so probably first and foremost, Dr. Rushi and I, when we are looking for cattle to purchase cattle for really any of our research projects, first place we look at is the source of origin, right? We prefer and nearly exclusively buy calves raised in South Dakota. There's some one-off situations where the needs of the question we're answering or the company we're working with that's a wanting to do research as a with us as a partner that dictates where we might have to deviate from that. But first and foremost is South Dakota calves. Historically, those calves are all for us at least. We're reasonably close to the cattle source. We can purchase these livestock from a variety of sale barns across the state, or even work with directly with ranch partners. These calves are they're one source, so single source calves in the appropriate weight and health category that we're looking to seek. And so that's one thing just in general that we don't have to worry about here being in a state with a lot of cattle and quite large cow herds is, but typically speaking, when we line up to do a beef cattle feeding experiment, we need somewhere between 120 and 240 animals in one go. And our preference is for those animals to be low health risk, cattle that have had the appropriate vaccinations, appropriate steroidal implantation at the right time. They're in the right stages of production. And then we need to be able to go get those calves, hopefully, from as minimal amount of sources as possible. And so that really, with we need 240 steers, we need to be going and hunting calves from a 500 head ranch. So larger cattle outfits that would work. And that's probably really true even in other situations for our stakeholders is for what we're trying to do and what we're trying to answer is a specific biological question relative to a nutrition strategy or a management intervention. And we want to be able to detect teeny tiny differences. Now that's not everybody's cattle purchasing model. Talk to Dr. Rushi and I'll hand this off to him, but you can buy cattle in lots of loads of 2 to 10 head, put those cattle together and add value to those calves and sell them as backgrounded calves. We're typically in this production chain from weaning till harvest. And so we're not looking for a bunch of odds and ends type cattle. We do grow all the feedstuffs that we use on campus. We buy a few co products from out and about in the country. But really, what we're looking for is single source calves that have been appropriately vaccinated, calves from a calving window that's not, 365 days long, and a reasonably tight weight distribution so that we can use those. So those goals are a little different than maybe what some stakeholders have, but certainly probably some similar things. They don't want to buy a load of calves with a 1,000 pounder and a 400 pounder. Things of that nature. Warren, I'm going to turn it off to you because you could talk a little bit more about the other, what our stakeholders might run into.
Well, and I'll kind of echo a little bit off of what Zach said. we buy try to buy a single source because that fits our research needs, minimize the variation. For a lot of our, cattle feeders across the region, they may or may not do that because one of the things that, everyone would love to get, be able to fill up your yard or several pens with single source cattle, that comes at a cost. And so from this year in particular, given where cattle values are, there's people looking at, either wanting to or needing to, excuse me, put cattle together in from multiple consignments into groups. So that's something we don't do. I am pretty familiar with it because when I was home, that was what our customers did. They bought up little packet, little to medium to big packages, put them together, and then our job was to keep them going and get them straightened out down the road. Guys, the nice thing about our business is there's multiple ways to do almost anything. There isn't a perfect system. There's trade-offs regardless of what we do. If we, those single source cattle are easy to manage, but a little you have to swallow a little harder in terms of what that cost is. Flip side, you can find some opportunity cattle at a lower cost, but they come with some challenges. So in terms of managing health and everything else, so it's really a question as much as anything of thinking about what is it you're good at, what do you have the resources to do, and what's your business model. For Zach and I here, our business model is a single source group of calves that are at or is close to what the maximum might be for genetic potential, and then we can start imposing treatments on them to start thinking about how do we what can we do to make beef production better. Or some, if it were our checkbook writing out cattle, we right buying the cattle, we may very well do it differently because of different objectives. So I think it comes down to, as much as anything, what are you good at? What is your goals in terms of what your the cattle feeding enterprise looks like?
That makes me think the classic extension answer is, well, it depends. But Zach, you gave some really good points, some principles you can keep to whenever you're purchasing. And then, like Warren said, what is your goal and what are your strengths? What do you have the capabilities of on your operation?
Right.
I would say a couple of the principles hold true across the board. The higher health status cattle are worth more money, and this year, given where the values of calves are, they're worth a lot more money to keep cattle that are healthy. So it's that if I were buying calves, that would be the first, second, and third thing on the list is are they healthy? After that, we can we can make light calves, small calves, fleshy calves, screen calves, all kinds of things work, and it's really hard to make cattle get sick. That turns into a train wreck really fast. So I think that health status is, while not, there are tolerances of people for risk and how much they're willing to deal with, it still becomes one of these real top of the mind attributes that are really important.
Warren, we always joke also. You notice Warren didn't say a single thing about a hide color or a breed. We're agnostic against that. The only thing we're probably not going to go out and willfully do here is bring a bunch of eared cattle. That's Texas slang for Brahman cattle or cattle with Bos Indicus influence. But aside from that, lots of the cattle in South Dakota are really good. And if they're healthy, we can find a management program and an avenue to work with those cattle.
Like you said, this year might be changing some people's plans because of the cattle price and the feed price. So if you look at that and say they are going to put together smaller groups, what are some things they need to do right away when those calves are arriving? Is it different receiving protocols? Is it a different type of ration? How hard and fast do you need to be on monitoring their health from day one?
I would say when you look at the cattle production through our lens, we're in a marathon and not a sprint. Okay, these calves that are weaned in the mid to late fall, so October into November, those calves are easily going to spend 300 to 340 days under our care. And so when we think about it, Things like implant technologies. We used to think we need to get it in them, maybe a little bit after arrival, but there's new labels on how we use and timing and stage of production when we apply those technologies. And so we're really that first 45 to 60 days is the minimum if you're buying cattle and warming them up for somebody. I'd say 60 days is how long you need to have them on your property before they go and enter a new marketing channel. But we look at this as a 350-day marathon, not a 350-day sprint. So we're going to take things easy. We've got some rules of thumbs we follow on all calves. Most of the calves that we receive are going to be balling calves. They're grouped up the morning, separated the morning. Oftentimes we start on a Monday because we got a lot of things to get through done before Friday. Calves are separated on Monday morning from their mother. They're transported 6 to 12 hours across the state to our facility. That first night they get there, we've got an open lot concrete facility. The only thing in the bunk is grass hay, and it's not chopped grass hay. It's long stem grass hay. It's flowing out of the bunk. We've got waterers filled to the brim. We want this to be as easy a transition from the prairie into the feedlot. Whenever we get calves in, we grow lots of silage. There's going to be lots of silage put up this year with the cost of what people are getting for corn in town. We got to remember those are fermented feeds, okay? And so we've got to, those are things that Warren and I think about on newly arrived calf nutrition management. So we're going to let them eat hay the first night. We're going to let them rest. Depending upon the information sharing through the production chain, if we knew they got shots or have had shots or have been poured, we're going to tailor our veterinary strategy along with our veterinarian to use the best possible outcome for those calves. But when I think about forages or feeds for these calves, not all hay is the same. Ditch hay is different than reed grass hay, which is different than haylage. And anytime we get a fermented feed in front of a what I call a naive calf, those become things we look at. So we're going to have hay in the bunk. We're going to have slow, low stress livestock handling. And we're going to pay attention to how those cattle respond to that hay delivered the first night. If they don't touch it, we're going to alter our feeding strategy for the next day. But it's really kind of a, I don't know, it's not a one size fits all approach. It's pretty fluid in the process of how we're looking and how we're reading what those cattle are doing. But we do know there are some things that can set us back. And so we think about hay, good hay, long stem hay that's of nice quality, that's not rain damaged. We don't want to feed wet fermented feeds at least the first day when we're thinking about hay in the bunk. Legume hays are not what we want to be feeding to newly weaned calves, at least as that hay, long stem hay in the ration. So those are some strategies we use on every set of cattle that become really important, especially when we're talking about a calf coming from the prairie into the feedlot. It's different if we go pick up some calves that were backgrounded in a dry lot that have been fed fermented forages and co-products. Well, we'll probably start them out at 1.75%, 2% of body weight as intake and just let them shoot to the moon.
Zach handled a lot of the diet things really, really well. The one thing I would add into that is this year, feed is cheap, cattle are valuable. So I think it is a mistake for people to overemphasize cost per pound and cost per ton on a diet, especially early on. Later, you bet. We'll figure out ways to beat this diet cost down if where it makes sense. That's the last place I want to be, tripping over dollars picking up patties. We need to make sure what they're eating is going to actually support growth. But back to your earlier question. All right, if we're either by choice or by necessity, having to start thinking about putting together more groups, I think some of that comes down to your facilities. Here's where having several smaller pens pays off, because now I can put the cattle that come in. I can start grouping them by arrival time. If I've got one 250 head pen and it takes me 3 weeks to get them all bought up and gathered, we just got those first ones up and going, and then we throw some new calves that in on top of them, and they don't know what to do. And meanwhile, some of the ones that came in between those groups, they're just now getting sick and affecting both ends. That's a case of if we're going to be picking up groups, ideally, I'd like to have them all penned up within where everything in that pen arrived at the yard within a week. And then we can now I can manage those as a set. I still got variation from herds, but at least I don't have as much variation in terms of where they're at in feed intake, where they are at in the terms of the disease curve. I think Taylor, you'd mentioned a little bit about handling. I am a huge proponent of there is not much substitute for the eye of the master and the person walking through the pens in terms of getting cattle used to being handled. I could give you a story from when I was home where the year I didn't do that because I couldn't, because I started my new career. We got along, we got lucky, cattle stayed healthy, but they were never easy to work with. And so that daily interaction, it's sometimes hard to measure in terms of, sickness rates or some other things, but it's really important in terms of being able to handle cattle, with minimal stress. How would we manage some of these? I'm getting into veterinarian area, so now you need to talk to a veterinarian. However, when a fairly common value on a weaned calf, this or a non-weaned calf, right out of the cow, is going to be somewhere around $2,500 a head. I think this deserves a second consideration on things like mass treatment, using whether that's some kind of antibiotic in the bottle or something that's in the feed. The consequences of having a 1% death loss is going to be on a bunch of calves we buy, it's going to be $25, $30 a head. So here's where this might where maybe 5 years ago that didn't make sense. The margins weren't there. I don't think that's true this year. So that's to me, that's a conversation to have now. Here we're doing this in early September. Have a conversation with your veterinarian about the plans for either the home raised calves we're going to wean or the calves we're going to buy as part of the fall run. Think about how are we going to manage those? What kinds do we think we're going to be buying? Are is the approach of I've always bought the top end in bigger groups, nothing's going to change, we're going to keep doing that. Or if we're venturing into some higher risk or more commingling or our risk levels increasing, how are we going to deal with that? Because certainly the dollar values that are at stake are much higher than any of us have ever seen, frankly.
Warren, I'm just thinking out loud here. It's tough. When we think about size of feedlot pens, at least in the circles we work in, everyone says they're 200 head, right? 200 to 250 head. Are there strategies or, not cheap, but quick, dirty, and easy, whether that's two strings of hot wire, the cattle panels, to maybe add supplemental waters to make this strategy so that when Warren said the disease curve, what he's talking about is cattle tend to break with disease 14 to 28 or 35 days after they get here. And if it takes you 2 to 3 weeks to fill that pen, you're starting at the break the curve, and you're going to have more get sick 2 to 3 weeks later. And so if we can group those up in smaller, lot level loads, 100 head pens, we can manage that disease in that pen much easier. You got any ideas on your? I mean, I'm thinking about these freestanding cattle
Yeah,
panels
that's what I was
for
going to
the
say.
little
You read my
hot wire.
mind. Those are they're all over. It seems like almost every small town's got a welding shop making some. To me, that's a very easy way that I can manipulate the pen size, and I can keep them up closer. I can divide some pens depending on the waters. There's a lot of things we can do with those. And then after a couple week or 2 weeks, when the group's going fine or somewhere in there, we can start combining and say, okay, now I've got, we got these cattle. They've all been here 3 to 4 weeks. They're probably all right. We'll put them together. We got them through part of that herd. The water issue, that,
Gets cold.
well,
I was
yeah,
gonna
that,
say we can hopefully do it before it gets cold, though.
yeah,
I don't
that's right.
start
Before
now.
Thanksgiving.
Depends on when cold weather hits. We may be able to get away with some, non-energy watering solutions for a while. Maybe there's a pen. I know this was when I was on my family's operation, at least our own calves, we had one pen we started our calves in. And give them a couple weeks, then they went into big pen. And so if we had been, depending on the, geometry of your yard, that could be the pen that we start a lot of calves in. Now, the downside is if we use that same pen for everything, your later cattle are getting exposed to whatever the first cattle had. But that's But maybe that's where that metaphylaxis or mass treatment comes into play too. So I think, as we talked about earlier, there's, and I couldn't tell on the audio whether this is Abby or Taylor that said it's the extension answer. It depends. Well, kind of does. And so looking at, facilities sometimes dictate what we can do, but it's very rare that they're facilities become such a barrier that they make certain things impossible. So we can do some things. We can manage around that. We just need to understand what kind of, animal husbandry and think steps might we need to take to accomplish that.
Say, Warren, I'm just sitting here doing some math, and I don't sell panels for a living, but say you get a 24-foot panel and it's $400 and you need six of those to run the back of a 150-foot pin. Well, now we're at $2,400 for the panel to split that pin. That's one dead calf.
Right. That's a
So it's
pretty
worth putting the
good
pencil to.
number. Yeah.
And it isn't like that piece of equipment becomes a single purpose thing that we never get to use. We can do all kinds of things with that. If we need to make some additional pens somewhere, I see those all over, in because they're we can move them. They're just kind of a handy product. And so I think that's one of those answers of, in a lot of cases, we may have those tools already in the yard. We just need to think about, bought them so we could do things during calving, but they also work to manage calves when we wean.
Standing panels, I don't, someone has referenced them before. They're kind of like the greatest thing since sliced bread, a little bit.
They're
Even no matter
handy.
what size, if you're a cow-calf operation, if you're a feedlot, they're able to, just, obviously stand and ready to go with it, whether you're changing your sorting facility with all these new calves coming in. So kind of a question, maybe for Addie here too, on terms of, receiving calves and, that low stress. What are some, like, is it the feedlot, I don't know, standhills calving system type of deal? Like, is the nose-to-nose contact with pens just as important to minimize as, before you bring them in together? Or how are some things you can look at that from like a biosecurity standpoint? If you're going to metaphylaxis one group, how soon or how long afterwards do you have to wait to put them in a pen with a group that's just been, bought and had the same process done to them, but it's 2 weeks apart, for example?
I can give the BQA standard, and that is keep new groups of cattle separate for 30 days. But you guys can take a practical perspective if you'd like.
Yeah, I don't disagree with 30. Now, that may or may not be as easily to implement, and it also depends too on risk. If I, let's say Taylor, let's say we were dealing with home raised calves, and we went and we got some of them weaned, and now we got to take a break because it's time to chop silage, and maybe we took out some earlage, and then we had to switch over to get the combine ready for beans, and so it ends up being 15 day, 2 3 weeks before we got around to the next group. I wouldn't be terribly concerned about maybe mingling those after 2.5 3 weeks. Where if I was lip side, if I'm sitting in the sale barn, I'm sitting in four barns a week and I'm buying groups of 10 and 20, that one, maybe I definitely want to keep those isolated for 30 days. So I think that that waiting period depends a lot on what our risk level is. The home raised calves are fairly low risk. We're really just keeping them, Zach, isolated so that they're kind of on the same, so we get them to the same point in terms of intake, where the other group, now we got to deal with some of those disease things, because as the more groups that I don't know if there is a formula, but in my head, the more groups, more herds that are represented in the pen, our health risks go up exponentially. Again, that's my gut call rather than a, I'm sure there's some science answer, but
There is. Vets
and
do it all the time. It's a epidemiological type outcome where you get more animals for more naive pathogens coming together. And so when we think about home raised calves and filling that weaning pen, what we're really they've all been exposed to the same bugs, if you will, the same things that are getting them sick. It's more management. When Warren said in training behavior, really, when Warren talks about that intake deal, it's, well, you got one group that was weaned 2 weeks earlier and they're up to 14 pounds of dry matter intake, and the other group's at sub maintenance because you just weaned them. And we really got to get those lined up on the same wavelength on intake. I'm not so worried about it as a pathogen risk load, but when we're filling pens for multiple cell barns, now we are bringing into the equation pathogens that make animals sick. So not only are we training them how to eat over a 3 week period and we're bringing new ones in, they're bringing new pathogens into the pen. On the home raised level, it's more just getting them, it's like you got two sets of a set of twins, and one learned to ride their bike in 1 week and he's taken off with mom, and the other one's taken 3 weeks and he's back at the house with dad trying to learn to pedal. That's what we're working with on home raised calves.
Yeah, the maybe one way to look at it is on the home raised calves, we're solving one problem. With the purchased calves, we've got two or three. We've got the disease things. We also have to, they're also learning how to eat. But then we've also got, you know, there's that get overcoming the stress of all the transportation, all the things we did. And that's different, you know, if cattle went to the sale barn versus the direct from the ranch. And so, you know, I think you can think of it as think of the stress load we put on calves. The bigger the load, the more we have to be careful of them with them when we get them to the yard, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense in terms of kind of two different strategies, two different problems. You're going to have to flux your intake receiving protocol based on what pen you're working with that day. Not to say you can't manage both, but you're going to have to do things differently. Kind of just keep going on the price of feed isn't going to be an issue this year, right? So I think we kind of talked a lot about, you know, the different rations, like you said, long stem hay, you know, lighter calves. We talked about off straight off the ranch, to, you know, maybe a backgrounded scenario. Is there different, you know, types of, I think you mentioned implant strategies you're going to kick off right away with those different things, or do you think people are going to do things differently? You know, before they offer them for sale this year too, or like how do you guys manage that conversation with the people you're buying them from, or you know, from the sale barns?
With and when it comes to cheap feed, is depending upon the weight class of cattle we're placing, the apparent risk. That's when we start thinking about all these things. You know, calves prefer highly palatable diets. We've got to think about where they're coming from, what they're coming into. They're grazing a prairie with forage that's beginning to decline. They've been drinking some milk. They've been eating whatever you've been tossing, mama, whether that's liquid feeds, or we call it cake down in Texas, protein supplementation. All those things become really important. You know, Warren and I and Dr. DeHaan, we've had good luck feeding calves a finisher the day they arrive. That's one research area we work in. So again, it really depends on what you can do. When I think about mixer loads and incoming cattle, the one thing, at least at our research feedlot, that takes a lot of time each day is feeding. And we want to optimize the loads that we're manufacturing. We want to minimize partial loads, and we want to have feeding done in a timely fashion without any breakdowns. And so that's really a talk that a stakeholder needs to have with their nutritionist or their feed sales representative of, okay, this looks good on paper. I know we've got this six diet steps to get them through here, but I've only got, you know, 5 or 6 hours of the day that I really want to be out here feeding. Okay, so there could be what we did in old days. Maybe we change it up. I don't know what I'm trying to say here, but there's a lot of ways to skin this cat. We could feed them a finisher on the first day. That's not for everybody. I don't recommend it, but it can be done. And we also want to optimize loads. We don't want a bunch of partial loads. We don't want to be going and getting a one-off thing that's special that improves this, but it's really hard to handle. And
So I was going to add something on that, you know, what Zach was talking about starting calves on a finisher. Really important to point out, we don't let them eat all they want.
yeah,
That's
that's
a
a good
very,
point.
very controlled way
We
to do
limit
it.
feed them.
You know, it because someone can hear that wrong, and that could be ugly. You know, I think Taylor, for as far as feed costs go, you know, to some extent, you know, at least in South Dakota, we always have We usually always have hay. We usually have some kind of silage. We've got grain. We've got co-products. We balance that in with some commercial supplements. We mix up our casserole, and we feed cattle. To some extent, our ingredients haven't changed that much. Now it's a little bit of, all right, what flavor are we going to do here? I think one of the potential ideas out there is going to be to take a look at buying lighter cattle that can take advantage of things like corn silage or some other roughage sources. When we have periods when grain gets cheap, the temptation is to feed more grain to backgrounding cattle, and that works until it doesn't, and we create a bunch of cattle that get a little too fleshy, and then we get discounts on the other end. So we do need to be careful about, we need to think of this in terms of a best cost rather than least cost, especially because what I don't want to do is mess up the sale value and then wreck my value again. So I think this is a case of, I'm not sure. In some ways, I don't know if we change anything or very much based on cost of feed. Now, that said, there's some wrinkles this year that might play into account. In the areas of the state that produce grain sorghum or milo, that right now, at least early September, that is an incredibly cheap feedstuff relative to corn. It may make some sense for people that have never fed milo before to take a look at it as a way to lower cost of gain. We certainly know these cattle are valuable and it creates a big investment to buy them. If we can come up with a lower cost diet that gives us the equivalent or near equivalent performance, that makes the margins work better. So there's always some variations on a theme, so to speak, but by and large, we're still going to be taking some combination of, well, what it will be in a lot of cases is what did we grow and what do we have that we need to market through cattle? And so then we'll come up with the mix that makes the most sense.
Or even more, not what did we grow, but what did we grow that we can sell in town, but what can we get from another part if trucking is reasonable? I mean, within the state of South Dakota, there's a $1 difference in cost per bushel. I mean, in certain parts of the state, it's corn's a buck back on the board. And so that's when the strategies of limit feeding a finisher may or may not work. And it's a nutritionist that you hire. They know they should know the strategy. They might not always want to try to do it, but it's all about caloric intake. All right, I can feed them this much corn and this much forage and effectively get them to the same out weight and flesh with different amounts of feed. So it can be done, and one should put a pencil to it. The Milo is going to be a good buy. Corn's going to be a good buy in a lot of places. Hay might be more expensive in other places. So really, this is the year to not trip up over it, but to think about capitalizing. We know calves are worth a lot, but the value of gain is worth a lot. And so if we can make those small adjustments, I think there's opportunities to return more revenue to the farm if you think it through and don't just shoot from the hip.
Yeah, I guess I'm always an advocate of, every year we reevaluate the feed markets and what do we have on hand and how do we best use that. Because this year certainly, across the board, for the most part, feed costs are cheap relative to everything else. Having said that, like that limit feeding approach, which we've talked about it over the years on things like even wintering cows and so forth. The other part is that you have to balance labor requirements too. It takes a little more attention, a little more management, and if those resources aren't available because maybe everyone's busy, then it might be a case of, yeah, we could save a little bit by doing that, but the trade-offs are high enough that I think we're going to do, maybe the decision then becomes we're going to do what we are good at, which is maybe feeding a silage, ground hay, corn, liquid supplement, modified distillers mix. And there's nothing wrong with doing that. It's, there, but it, I look at it as I'm going to evaluate the opportunities and then determine which ones make sense.
I used to get that question a lot of how much silage can I feed? How much corn silage will a cow eat? Or, how much corn silage can a calf eat? Because that seems to be the biggest pile in the feedlot, right? Or, at the ranch. It's the biggest pile and they feel like they have a lot of it, so they want to use the most of it. And whether it's 50 bushel an acre, corn that it was chopped off of, or 200 bushel corn an acre it was chopped off, makes a huge difference. But they think it's just corn silage.
Oh.
And in a year like this, Taylor, that I think is going to come into play because, almost everyone we work with is a, they've got a foot in both worlds. So you've got cattle and we're farming. And this year, the cattle side of their brain is very happy. The farming side of the brain's not so much. And so one of the opportunities to maximize revenue on the farming side is run those crops through cattle. And so silage becomes part of that. So yeah, I expect we are going to have that kind of question a lot as to what is the upper limit? And
We've done the studies, Warren.
Zach and I have done some of that. We relearned that 450-pound calves, there's a limit on the silage we can make them eat. Flip side, we can put more silage into finishing cattle diets than what the book or what the cool kids say you can do. And come up with acceptable performance. So, back to whoever made the comment of the extension answer, it depends. It really does. It does make our jobs fun in that we've got different options and different approaches we can use to solve them.
Yeah, so you guys did a good job of touching on or really getting into how we can utilize the different feedstuffs that may be available this year, maybe a little cheaper if you're just going to sell them versus maybe somebody wants to feed those. They've never finished cattle before, but they want to utilize their crops that way. So, what are some tips that you guys would give those people who are trying to finish their cattle this year, maybe haven't done it before, have some cattle experience, but don't have a whole lot of that finishing experience?
We got to remember we're in a 300 and 300 day minimum marathon on these wean calves till finish. If you've got questionable facilities and you don't think you can handle a March blizzard or mud, these are things when it's okay to look through the mirror and be like, man, this looks good, but I don't want to have a wreck later. We've noticed in our facilities that were built in the 1960s, a lot of them don't have enough concrete, okay? And those make for the worst springs for feeding cattle, becomes an animal welfare issue. Penstocking density needs to be watched. So if it's questionable, I'd be careful. Get out when you got the money and you can make money at that stage or when you get rid of them. So facilities design would be the first thing I look at. Even if you've got the feed, the first thing I would question is, am I set up to go through spring? We don't know if winter's going to be horrible or easy again this year, but those are things I'd be managing and looking at and ready to pull the trigger without a lot of emotion. I need to have, it's not that we aim to do this and now we're in a wreck. If we're in a wreck, a lot of other people are in a wreck. So really, before you commit to this strategy, I'd really make sure that you've got the right place to do it at moving forward, because you can get out at a certain time. If you're in it and everybody else is in it, it's going to get ugly.
It's not
Bye.
as easy to cut the fence on kind of
No.
fat cattle as it is cows, right?
No,
Like
you can't
you
cut them
can't
and
just
let them
move
go out
them.
to
Yeah.
the patch of grass and let them ease up on the mud.
The other thing, Addie, you talked, there's a couple different types of people in that. There's let's suppose you are an operation that's back, weaned and backgrounded and looking at maybe, extending into some finishing period. That's and Zach brought up a great point on the facilities. That's that would be where I start. That going from a backgrounding enterprise to adding finishing, it's a modest step. I would, if they're not, depending on who they're working with, I'm a nutritionist, get in touch with someone who's comfortable advising them on finishing cattle. Is that I've run into people where they've made that step and things were a little bumpy. So go in, ask some questions, figure out what the plan is. We do not have to feed there. We grow a lot of roughage in South Dakota. We've talked already about silages and hays and so forth. They're kind of a bit of a security blanket in terms of feeding cattle and an insurance policy. We don't have to push, not everyone has to push the envelope as far over as we possibly can to try to get, an 8-9% roughage diet or less to maximize a feed efficiency. There's nothing wrong with feeding a 15% roughage because it's nice and easy. The cattle will get fat, may take them a couple weeks longer, but they're going to get there. The other audience Eddie talked about is, people that hadn't done that before. I don't want to say they can't because everyone starts somewhere. Just make sure then they really are getting some advice and some input as to do it. It's not as easy as simply saying, well, gosh, I've got a whole bunch of 350 corn or less. I don't like selling it in town. I'm going to feed cattle and I've never done it before. And knowing our families had livestock for 40 years, that learning curve is kind of steep. And and it's not like they get to buy $800 feeder steers right now either. So I wouldn't I would never tell anyone they can't. What I would encourage those folks is to Eddie is to get some input so they understand what resources they need, what kind of time commitment is there, understand how are we going to manage these calves. Because the only thing worse than having to sell grain in town at too low a price is to invest a whole lot more money in a set of cattle, buy yourself a lot more work over the winter, and then end up when it was all said and done that you would have still been better off just selling the corn. So I think that for that portion of our South Dakota farm audience, that it. It's tempting, but it just needs to be entered into carefully.
I think that's some good points, especially with the way the markets are right now. We're seeing a lot of open heifers go through the market, for example, and yearlings and things. And you could probably add some pretty cheap gain to those right now, too. I mean, that would be a different avenue to go and kind of off topic from what we started with talking today about receiving calves. But there's different times in the cattle cycle you can jump into, feeding cattle with a little bit less risk.
And the other part, Taylor and Addie, back to that, that individual's got crops that are cheap. But maybe there's a neighbor, maybe there's a young family that's they've got the skill, they got the desire to do it, and they've got facilities that would work. But capital is an issue. Maybe partner with them, and say, all right, I've got some feed. Maybe there's some, we'll figure out a way to where this becomes a win-win for everybody. Yeah. So there's a lot of opportunities. It's just a question of, all right, figure out which one of these makes some sense. And then thinking through all the logistics and business aspects of that.
All right, I think we're getting close to through most of the questions that we had today. But to kind of circle back around, any last thoughts on really the time of year that we're in with receiving those calves? The weather has been great, I guess, the last couple of weeks, but we never know how long that's going to stick around. We don't know when snow will fly, but just any last comments from each of you on people getting those calves on feed the right way and how to survive and succeed through the fall.
I've got a couple, and these are, I'm cheating a bit. They're off of an article I wrote a few years ago that's on the website. But one of the things we haven't really touched on is water. That is the number one. If they don't drink, they don't eat. If they don't eat, they get sick, they don't gain. So,
Good point.
water, making sure we've got plenty of it and it's good quality, critically important. Some of the other things, see a lot of places where, well, we'll put in self-feeder hay ring and maybe a creek feeder in the back and back of the pen, maybe some lick tubs, some stress tubs, some other things. Those approaches are less successful than putting a good mixed diet in the barn, in my opinion, because we have too much variation in what cattle eat. So I realize sometimes we're dealing with some constraints on facilities, but gosh, if we can move away from that, move away from letting the animal pick what they eat to forcing them to eat what we've designed, the better off we're going to be. A couple other things. From a management standpoint, for 10 months out of the year, when if those cattle are on feed for 300 days, for 260 of them, I'm gonna not be too concerned whether you feed once a day, twice a day, do what works. That first month, I really like you to feed them twice a day, if for no other reason, because it forces us to look at them more often, helps some of those more timid cattle get up to the bunk. Because once we get them over the hump of eating, and then they're a lot easier to manage. It's much, once they get them to, day 30, day 45, then this becomes a lot less complicated.
Warren, I'm with you. I wouldn't say you can't do it. I'd recommend against it, but hay ring feeding newly weaned calves is not the way to do it. We want to hand feed that. We're training them to come to that bunk. As Warren mentioned, the health, the potential to manage and optimize animal husbandry by them cat those cattle standing up, coming to the bunk, putting their head in there. Now, that's an easy tool to be used to assess cattle health. If they're not coming to the bunk when you feed them twice a day, and they're cleaning, the other calves are cleaning their feet up, that critter needs to be taken a look at. Okay, he needs to be pulled and be managed. So you can't say never because it depends. But a hay ring feeder and a pen for newly weaned calves is about the one of the worst
It's
management techniques.
harder. I think we can do it if we're hand feeding the supplement. It at least becomes easier. But if I can, if you've got certainly if you have enough of them where we can justify a mixer wagon, that is, to me, that is the approach to do.
The twice a day feeding deal, Warren, I'm so glad you brought that up. I should have had cheater notes. That time period when we're starting those calves off, and I'm just going to use a theoretical 550 weight calf here. That first day, he's getting long stem hay in the bunk and about 3 to 4 pounds of dry of as-fed feed. It's about 2 pounds of dry matter. We're going to bump those cattle up pretty quickly. We want to get them to about 14 pounds on the 14th day. And during that climb and intake, 14 pounds of dry matter. During that climb and intake, what we're watching is the cattle's response to feed being delivered to the bunk. They should, if they're healthy and coming along as they should, they know that that feed's not going to last long after maybe the first or second day. Their buddies are going to eat it. We want to see them all up there at the bunk having uniform consumption. And any of the critters that hold back, there's a problem in that calf, whether it's an ear down, a starter respiratory, a sore shoulder from the trip over. But at $2,500 a head, he deserves attention. Well, he deserves attention when they're $800 a head. Those management strategies that we use starting calves, the twice a day feeding, them coming up to the bunk, gauging their speed at which they consume the feed, and those things, those are critical tools to animal welfare and health that are like, they're free. They don't have to pay any money. It's not in a bottle. It's not a wearable device. It's the intuition of the cattle feeder. So, strongly recommend that. Good thing you brought that up, Warren.
Do you think that makes a difference if you're using fence line feed bunks versus driving in the pen? But I just wonder,
Well,
for some of our smaller feeders, if
yeah.
you're disrupting their, system by simply driving in there twice a day, it still should get them up and help them, look at them, as you're saying.
I talked about it at our operation. We had this yard that, we'd start a lot of calves in. That was a drive-in pen. It was a hassle because someone had to be right there at the gate because the little rats would want to all get out. But to me, that's a assuming the conditions are dry. If this is muddy and everything else, that's a different deal. But if it's dry, I don't really care. In fact, I kind of sort of like it because you put those bunks right in the middle of the pen, and it makes it so that they encounter feed more often. And encountering feed and water, that was a term I had Dr. Pritchard had shared with me once, that setting things up so that they don't have a that they accidentally run into feed encourages intake. Where if we've got especially a larger pen where the bunk is off on the fence and maybe the nice high dry spots over a ways off, they don't find it as often. So I'm early on, Kaler, I'm not sure I care that much on whether we have to drive in or not. It's more a case of the more times we give those calves chances to get up to the bunk, the more apt they are to figure out that that tractor or that truck means feed. That person walking around the pen is a good thing. He's my buddy. He's going to help me. Those are all things that help them make that adjustment And then once we get them over that, then we can, we can switch them over to the J bunks, and we can run once a day if that's what fits our labor needs. We can do a lot of different things once we got them going.
For
And
sure.
last thing on that, does timing of day, is morning better than afternoon, or can that just kind of be variable based on your schedule?
Depends. Yeah, so
It
for
depends.
me, back to the starting, I still want to do it twice a day. After that, there's data that says feed them in the afternoon because it helps in terms of heat, taking advantage of heated fermentation in the winter and avoiding the peak heat in summer. I come back to tell me what you can do well, and
Yes,
then let's do
once a
that.
day. That's exactly right.
Our yard at Beresford Southeast Farm, we feed cattle nearly all the time in the morning. Unless it's extremely hot, then Scott, the manager, will shift over and do some afternoon things. But most of the time it's in the morning. And I'll be frank, we fed in the morning too, and most of it is because, Murphy, we all heard of Murphy's Law. Murphy lives on feedlots and cattle operations. And sometimes feeding in the morning meant we got it done because we got a chance to get the snow moved and fix some other things where maybe in, if there was a breakdown in the afternoon, evening feeding, it pushes things really late. So I think it depends a whole lot on the individual operation, more so than a hard, and I hate hard, fast rules. Especially for our South Dakota farmers and farm families, where they're wearing a lot of different hats. It's tell me what you can do well, and then we'll work around the rest.
Yep. It's very true.
This has been some great information on lots of different things. Addie, do you have anything else?
I'm good.
All right.
Nope.
Well, with that, thank you, Dr. Rushi, Dr. Smith, for joining us. We can find more information on receiving calves on the Extension website, extension.sdstate.edu. We can share your guys' contact information with our podcast listeners as well. So don't
Sounds
be
good.
strangers, and hopefully we'll have some people reaching out to you with questions, or we'll pass them on to you. So with that, this has been Cattle HQ, brought to you by SDSU Extension, headquarters for all things beef cattle. Visit extension.sdstate.edu for the latest beef information. Until the next episode, stay curious and keep learning.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Cattle HQ, brought to you by SDSU Extension, headquarters for all things beef. We invite you to visit extension.sdstate.edu for the latest beef information, as well as subscribe to the show on Spotify. You will also find show notes and resources from today's episode. Until next time, remember, success is not a goal, it's a byproduct.